We're looking at 1 Kings 4 and 5. We're looking at 1 Kings 4 and 5. I'm not going to read all of it. I'm going to read from 1 Kings chapter 4, verse 20, through to chapter 5, verse 4. So 1 Kings chapter 4, starting at verse 20. Judah and Israel were as many as the sand by the sea. They ate and drank and were happy. Solomon ruled over all the kingdoms from the Euphrates to the land of the Philistines and to the border of Egypt. They brought tribute and served Solomon all the days of his life. Solomon's provision for one day was 30 cores of fine flour and 60 cores of meal, 10 fat oxen and 20 pasture-fed cattle, 100 sheep, besides deer, gazelles, roebucks and fattened fowl. For he had dominion over all the region west of the Euphrates, from Tifsha to Gaza. Over all the kings west of the Euphrates, he had peace on all sides around him. And Judah and Israel lived in safety from Dan to Beersheba, every man under his vine and under his fig tree, all the days of Solomon. Solomon also had 40,000 stalls of horses for his chariots and 12,000 horsemen. And those officers supplied provisions for King Solomon and for all who came to King Solomon's table, each one in his month. They let nothing be lacking. Barley also and straw for the horses and swift steeds they brought to the place where it was required, each according to his duty. And God gave Solomon wisdom and understanding beyond measure and breadth of mind like the sand of the seashore. So that Solomon's wisdom surpassed all wisdom of the peoples of the East and all the wisdom of Egypt. For he was wiser than all other men, wiser than Ethan the Ezrahite, and Heman, and Calcol, and Darda, the sons of Mahol. And his fame was in all the surrounding nations. He spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs were 1,005. He spoke of trees from the cedar that is in Lebanon, to the hyssop that grows out of the wall. He spoke also of beasts and of birds and of reptiles and of fish, and people of all nations came to hear the wisdom of Solomon and from all the kings of the earth who had heard of his wisdom. Now Hiram, king of Tyre, sent his servants to Solomon when they heard that he had been anointed king in place of his father, for Hiram always loved David. And Solomon sent word to Hiram, "You know that David, my father, could not build a house for the name of the Lord his God because of the warfare with which his enemies surrounded him until the Lord put them under the soles of his feet. But now the Lord my God has given me rest on every side. There is neither adversary nor misfortune. And so I intend to build a house for the name of the Lord my God. As the Lord said to my father, your son, whom I will set on your throne in your place, shall build the house for my name." Joy in serving the Lord. Because I think we know we should, but if we're honest, we often don't. And where our joy becomes a chore because of disappointment, resentment, and it just can be hard work. And we could think of lots of reasons why that might be the case, and that would be a valid exercise to think about why we do that. But in the reading that we looked at, and certainly if I read earlier and carried on, there is there the answer to that problem that we all sometimes feel and perhaps sometimes then feel guilty about as well. And what this section of 1 Kings is that it's the high point of the kingdom. And it's a sample of what the kingdom could be and what it actually points towards what it will be. And it shows us and shows God's people what we're working towards. Now, to make sense of some of these narrative bits of the Old Testament, sometimes we need to step back a bit. We kind of did that looking at just one verse in Romans, but we need to do it with the whole Bible. We need to sort of step back and look at the whole picture, the big picture for a moment, and orientate ourselves where we are in the Bible. So the Bible starts with the creation and the fall. And the situation there is Adam and Eve are living in Eden, a place that's perfect, and they're ruling over creation, and they're in perfect harmony. They're in perfect harmony with one another with God and with the creation where they're living. And after the fall, they're excluded from Eden, and the creation they live in is disordered, and the harmony is broken with themselves, you know, between each other and other people, with creation and with God. And the end of the Bible finishes with it being restored. In fact, not just restored, but improved. In some ways, what we have at the end of the Bible is better than the paradise we start with. And the whole Bible is, how do we get from there to there? And the history of Israel is in some ways a mini version of what happens. So what happens with humanity when humanity is just Adam and Eve, and how we end with new creation or hell, Israel is a picture of what happens to all of humanity. So God rescues them from a land of slavery in Egypt and takes them to a promised land, and it's described like Eden. And also he expels them from that land because of their sin, like Adam and Eve were expelled from Eden, and then they're brought back to that land. And the book of 2 Kings ends at that point in the Bible. So it ends with them in exile. And so it covers hundreds of years from Saul, in fact, before Saul, through to the them in exile. And the point of the book, we've seen this before when we've looked at it, the point of the book is answering a pastoral question for those in exile. How did we get here? But also, what hope do we have about returning? And as those people would have read this, they'd look at Solomon and say, here is our hope, and here's how it could be. And if I were alive at the time of Solomon, I think, probably, I would have thought that he is the Christ, the promised Messiah. And in these chapters, we see that he is the new Adam, the new humanity of sorts, that he is the promised King and Christ who rules the world and creation, so that rules it justly, so that his people find joy in what they do. Now, of course, it turns out he's not completely that, is he? Not entirely. And he's in fact the start of where the problems start to go down from there. But he points us to Jesus Christ. And he does that in a way, you know, why don't we just go straight to the answer and look at Jesus Christ? Well, part of the reason is that Solomon, as David and others, give us colour and depth to understand what Jesus is doing and saying when he comes on the scene. And what we see here is how our service can be led to deeper joy. Let's see how. So the first thing we see is about wise ruling. And that's at the start and the end of chapter 4. So looking at verses 1 to 19 and 29 to 34. There's lots in our news at the moment about leadership and about leaders, isn't there? So here in the UK, a lot about cronyism. I watched a bit of Question Time, and obviously it's directed a couple of scenarios of contracts and lobbying. But actually, it's been going on for decades. So there's an issue in the UK of cronyism. There's been lots in the news about the EU and the US, different scenarios, but bad choices that have been made, bad leadership and choices that they've got to make. Lots about China, Hong Kong, Myanmar, about tyranny, not to put too fine a point on it. And also, sadly, quite a lot in the news about Christian leadership and about the abuse of leadership, or leadership used in abusive ways. And the result of that for many people is anti-leadership. But no, that's not the answer here. The answer is not anti-leadership. You don't remedy bad leadership with no leadership, but to remedy it with good leadership and wise leadership. And that leads to the people flourishing. No leadership doesn't, bad leadership doesn't, but good wise leadership leads to people flourishing. And that's the picture we have here. So verses 2 to 19, Solomon has delegated leaders. And some of them are about spiritual matters, some of them about state matters. And he divides up the nation into regions and then puts people in charge of those regions. And so he involves others and invests them with real authority. And also he chooses well. And so it's interesting, he's king. He has all authority, but he delegates authority. He shares, he's leading. He has other people who rule and serve the nation. The church, God's people. And the emphasis is that wisdom doesn't originate in Solomon, but God. It's from God via Solomon, and he rules wisely and gets other wise people to rule under him. And wisdom from God is often, we've seen this sort of thing before, often counterintuitive, because Christianity is a revealed religion. And sometimes it tells us the opposite to what we'd expect. So sometimes we think, really, will that really work? Well, it's kind of the wrong question. It's, you know, we're talking about evangelism, or how we mature as a Christian, how we know God, how we worship. These things are revealed to us. That we can't work them out by common sense or how other people do it. It's something that needs to be revealed to us. We go from God's word. But other things, and we see some of that in this passage, is quite pragmatic, everyday issues. So Solomon wants to build a temple. He needs wood. It's quite practical in that way. And also around the second, you get these lists of names. The second list of names, there are 12 names. Oh, that's a familiar number, the 12 tribes of Israel. So an emphasis here, Solomon rules all of Israel. And so he's ruling all of the people. So verses 29 to 34, we then get the extent of his wisdom. And so verse 29, and God gave Solomon wisdom and understanding beyond measure and breadth of mind like the sand of the seashore. So it surpassed all those of Egypt, all those of the east. Even verse 31, he's even wiser than Ethan the Ezraite or Heman and these other people. I have no idea who they are. Presumably these people did. 3,000 proverbs, 1,005 songs, seems very precise. Verse 33, about nature. He knows all about plants and different kinds of animals, birds, fish, reptiles, and others. And verse 34, it says, and the people of all nations came to hear the wisdom of Solomon and from all the kings of the earth who had heard of his wisdom. So we're meant to notice two things. The extent of his wisdom, and the very topics of his wisdom. It covers all of creation. And that also he is greater than anyone else's wisdom in the world at the time. There's obviously some specific spiritual issues he shows wisdom on, but actually there's no kind of boundary. God's wisdom has no boundaries. It's relevant in all situations, whether it's biology and zoology, horticulture, economics. God's wisdom applies in everything. And the significance of that is the result of his wisdom is blessing in verses 20 to 28. Now, at this point, Israel and Judah are united and happy. They're numerous and they're wealthy. At the end of 2 Kings, they're everything but. So they're divided, they're exiled, they're few, and they're poor. And so what we see here is it's very good to be ruled by Solomon. It's very good to be ruled by God's anointed king. But the significance is more than just that. It's not just saying wisdom is good for you. Submit to wise leadership or be a wise person. It will be good for you. It is, but it's more than that. Because for sure, if you are wise and if you have wise leaders, you will not necessarily experience the results that we see here. But the way, what we're meant to see here is, and the author is very careful in how he words it so that we do see this, is we see the blessings of wisdom here are specific, that they're covenant blessings, that we see the echoes of the covenant here, particularly the covenant promises that were made to Abraham and the blessings that were promised to Abraham and to David. For example, we've already seen it about the 12 and all Israel and Judah, that they're all functioning together, unity and joy as a people, verse 20, that their numbers, not just that there were lots of them, but specifically how they're described, like the sand by the sea, that comes up twice. There are as many as the sands of the sea. That was the promise to Abraham. His descendants would be like sand on the sea. The geographical extent, so we get the boundaries, so way beyond Israel as we see it anywhere else in the Bible or even as it is today. So the extent of those boundaries and they're growing. Other nations in verse 21. So other nations are coming under the authority of God's king. Wealth in verse 22, and dominion, peace, and safety, and rest. So rest, remember, rest isn't in the Bible, isn't putting your feet up, but rest is no opposition from enemies, no threats, and being at peace with God. It's the reversal of the fall. started with Jesus saying, come to me and I'll give you rest. So that's when verses 23 to 25. So this all sounds like covenant blessings under a wise anointed king or Christ. And all these things were promised to Abraham and also promised to David that his son would do this, and he would do this forever. Also notice verse 27. He says, and the officers supplied provisions for King Solomon and for all who came to King Solomon's table, each one in his month. They let nothing be lacking. So the king's table is always well stocked. Well, you'd expect that from a successful, powerful, ancient Near Eastern king. But it's not just that. Did you notice it? It's an open table. So the officers make sure that the king's table is full, but it's an open table, and he brings various people round his table in rotation. And later we'll see that that will include Gentiles, the nations. So we're seeing here Solomon brings Abraham's promises about, and it looks like he's starting to. And also he is, as David's son, he's the promised Christ who starts to bring those things together that God promised to David. But also he's like a new Adam. He's like a new humanity because he's ruling the land or the world, same word, and he has dominion. Interesting word there. He has dominion over them as Adam was supposed to. And it's an expanding dominion with expanding wealth. So beginning of Genesis, it talks about these signs of wealth that Adam and Eve were meant to go out and explore and get, but don't really. And he has knowledge of plants and animals, of all of these things. His knowledge is like the sand of the sea as well. An interesting play of words is the Hebrew word for riddle and for dominion is there's only one word difference. So there's a little play on words there that he has. His knowledge and dominion are related. And we know already, don't we? We need a new Adam. Adam is the first man, and Eve is the second man. Everyone is under Adam, and everyone is in Adam. And so because he fell, we've all fallen. We need a new start. We need a new humanity. And Solomon is beginning to look a bit like that, to restore what the first Adam lost. But just as we're getting excited about how brilliant Solomon is, if you were sitting in exile, you'd sort of go, well, why am I in exile then? Well, verse 26, it says Solomon also had 40,000 stalls of horses for his chariots and 12,000 horsemen. So in the list, we have this list either side of that verse, which is indicating Solomon's success and how much God has blessed him and how what his wisdom has achieved. So we might not notice verse 26. Verse 26, as we read through that, verse 26 is just another example of his success. So we might not have noticed that he's also breaking God's law. That in God's law, we're told that kings are not to amass for themselves too many horses, and they're also not to have chariots, because that's what the nations do. That's what the kings of the nations do. And that's what it is to rely on your chariots and not to rely on God. So this is a bit like what we saw with David in 2 Samuel, isn't it? That as you read through 1 and 2 Samuel, you get David as the ideal king. And he is. He's brilliant. Until Bathsheba. And of course, it all goes wrong there. Then after Bathsheba, we find out there's other failings that David has. But when we then read back over 1 and 2 Samuel, even when it's saying, look how brilliant David is, there are little clues of if he's going to fail, here's where he's going to fail. We see that although he's been given this positive light, there are little indications that he's not perfect. And in fact, specific clues of where he will fail. And we've got the same here now with Solomon. So we've already heard about Pharaoh's daughter. We now hear about chariots, and these things are going to come back on him a bit later. So the problem with David and Solomon is their very success leads to their failure. Their strengths are their weaknesses. And of course, it means that we're looking for another king, doesn't it? One that will not fail and will not use the weapons of this world, but of another. But just before we go there, let's just take stock and evaluate for a second. we do learn something here about leadership, don't we? And about ourselves. The problem with many churches and Christians, especially Christian leaders, is that they have been wise and blessed and skilled, and they bless others, but their success leads them to various kinds of worldliness, depending on the leader you're talking about. So Solomon was wise above all other rulers, and he was leading well. He experienced great blessings. He was a great blessing. But now he wants a worldly sign of power. He wants chariots. That will keep the baddies at the door, chariots. And we need to be aware then, when things are going well, or rather we need to think about how we define what going well is. God uses weak vessels, but I want a chariot, or whatever an equivalent of a chariot for me would be. Now, the third thing we see here is the service of the king. Remember, we're thinking about how we find joy in the Lord. Service of the king in chapter 5. Now, there's an interesting apparent contradiction in chapter 4 and 5. Often when something in the Bible appears out of place or odd or perhaps a contradiction, a bit of digging round finds that actually is some great fruit in there. So in chapter 4, 23 to 35, we've got that, we already looked at it, Solomon's expanding empire. And if you look on the map, on the places that is mentioned, it stretches well into Lebanon, well beyond Tyre. But here in chapter 5, Hiram, the king of Tyre, which is basically the bottom of Lebanon, and they're getting these trees from Lebanon, and he's in charge of that. The king of Tyre, Hiram, and Solomon look like equals. You notice how they discuss things. They sound like equals. And in chapter 5, verse 13, Solomon uses Israel for forced labor. That sounds bad, doesn't it? I wouldn't like that. So it doesn't match the picture of chapter 4, does it? What's happening? Well, it's all part of the picture of Solomon's wisdom. Last time we zoomed off to Gloucester last week, but a couple of weeks ago was Easter Day, and we were still looking at Solomon on Easter Day because of the connection between Solomon's supernatural wisdom and its link with resurrection. So God's wisdom and power is seen in the cross and resurrection, but it, to the world, it looks like folly and weakness. And as we read through this, we would naturally lump chapter 4 in with chapter 3, thinking about wisdom, and chapter 5 in with chapter 6, thinking about the temple. But it's interesting that the Hebrew, chapter 4 ends in verse 20, and chapter 5 starts in what we call chapter 4, verse 21, and carries through to the end of chapter 5 as we know it. And so that's what we see in English, and as it happens in every other language, in the Greek Old Testament that predates Jesus, all has it as we do. But the Hebrew, 4:21 is 5:1. We're meant to see the two chapters joined together. So chapter 5 is getting ready for chapter 6 to prepare for the temple. And so it's very pragmatic. Solomon goes to Hiram, who has a lot of wood, for help. He needs quality wood. So you go to Hiram, the cedars of the Lebanon, get some help. And Solomon suggests terms to Hiram. Hiram modifies those terms and they agree together on what they're going to do. And Hiram brings building materials to Solomon, and Solomon takes food to Hiram. And they sign a treaty, it says. Only the Hebrew doesn't say it signs a treaty. It says they cut a covenant. So you think, is this just about politics? Is this a good bit of politics? We see this sort of, you know, this is seeing a lot of this post-Brexit, aren't we? Trade deals. Is this a Israel-Lebanon trade deal? They cut a covenant. These ideas come together in 5:13 to 18. The forced labor isn't perhaps what we thought. The forced labor we see is 1 month on, 2 months off. It's a bit like people who serve in the Navy. They often have 8 months on and several months off. So you can imagine being in a family from Judah. A family would run a small holding. Perhaps one of them had a trade, or they would share a trade between them as a family. And then dad has to go to Lebanon for a month to chop down trees or help import them back to Israel. The wife and the kids, the extended family and the neighbours will help. Families in most of the world don't work like ours. It's not just your household. It's you work across with your neighbours and your family. Most of them you would have been related to down the road. And so you all help together, and dad returns for 2 months. So 1 month away, 2 months at home, and only for the length of the project. So really, this isn't so bad. It's not as bad as it sounds straight away. And so there's no contradiction between this and the joy of chapter four. In fact, this forced labor is contributing to their joy, and they know what they're trying to get to. We also notice that some of Solomon's deputies had great wealth. And so we see in these verses, Solomon has people over Tyre and beyond. So Hiram and Solomon, they negotiate and they sign a treaty. They cut a covenant, like Abraham does with God and others. But it's not one of equals. Solomon is the greater king over Hiram. But he's not like an ancient Near Eastern tyrant. So if you were to go to the British Museum, you can find examples of Hittite treaties and various other ancient Near Eastern covenants. And they said they would cut a covenant. And it talks about a suzerain and a vassal, or a greater and a lesser. And it's not all bad being a vassal state. It means you are protected from the other big states. But it could also be brutal at times. And if you resisted, well, you wouldn't want to be a vassal resisting a suzerain. And certainly what vassals not do is negotiate. They do not readjust the terms of the covenant. But Solomon is different. He's gracious. Remember, the land is at rest and peace. There are no battles here. And yet his borders are expanding. And other nations are coming under his authority. So it looks here he's unlike a typical expanding ancient Near Eastern kingdom. So he doesn't beat Hiram into submission. Hiram willingly submits. So this is the Lord Jesus before. He does not beat you into submission. He loves you into submission. And we willingly submit to such a king. So the start of God's covenant with Abraham and then with David is being fulfilled here in Solomon. Kings and nations are bringing blessing to Israel's king, to his Christ. They're bringing their wealth to Jerusalem in these expensive stones and quality cedar wood. But for the first time in the Bible, a king of Israel takes goods out. He is blessing and providing Hiram with food. So he brings his tribute to Solomon. Solomon gives him provision. The kings bring homage to Christ. Christ provides to the nations. So hard labor is the words we have here. It's not mincing its words, is it? It is hard labor. But it's not futile labor. And it's not abusive use of power and of their labor. And it leads to blessing and joy with sitting at the king's table. Now, what a contrast we see with much of leadership, even sadly, leadership we often see in church. When someone is over somebody, someone is given a position of authority over others. But here we see it's more like coming alongside others. There's no dispute that there's a power differential, that one has authority over the other, but comes to the side, not abusing his power. And when he's being demanding, and he is demanding, he's not being overbearing. Jesus talks about leadership, and he said it's the first, but others, the first must be last, last be first. So to lead, and is leading, you do so by putting your own needs at the bottom of the pile, not getting what you want. We're putting other people's needs, not necessarily wants, but other people's needs before your own desires and needs and wants. And the purpose of this work is the temple. We'll come to think about that later. But the place where God meets with his people. So Solomon, the king, the anointed king, the Christ, provides a way to meet with God. Now, we've been thinking about this in Haggai, haven't we? We've taken a bit of a break from Haggai. We will finish it, I promise. But we've seen how this all applies to the church. So the temple is one building in a special and specific location. And the church, in contrast, is God's people gathered in any location. And it's likened to God's temple and house, but also, as we thought this morning, Christ's body. Think about that in Romans 12. So it's not so much that we read Christ into Solomon, but the high points of Solomon's rule sets a pattern for his greater son, what we might expect to see him do. So Jesus Christ, by the Holy Spirit, is building his kingdom through his people. He's building up his people, his body, his temple. And just as Hiram brought his wealth to Solomon, that's just a tiny start of what we begin to see. We now see many more doing the same to Jesus Christ. And the Bible ends with peoples and the rulers and the kings from all nations coming to him and bringing the wealth of nations to him and before his feet. And that's what worship is, isn't it? We do it offering our bodies. We do it with our finances, of offering ourselves, bringing our wealth in the broader sense to the feet of Jesus Christ. In return, now we ask for our daily bread. Then he will give us, he will allow us to eat of the tree of life. Now he invites us to his table at the Lord's Supper. Then we will eat at the table, the great wedding banquet of Christ to his people, where amazingly, not only is Jesus the groom, but in Luke's gospel, we see that he's also the waiter. He is the one who waits on us at the table. And now we may feel like this is hard work. We may feel that it is forced labor, but it is worth it because it's God's program. I started the service with these words. Jesus said, "Come to me, all who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light." Notice Jesus does say he has a yoke. He doesn't say, "I have nothing for you to do." He has a yoke. He does bring us, if you like, forced labor. He makes his demands. But he also says that they are light. They are light, and in him we have rest. The alternative to laboring for Jesus is far worse. And rest, remember, is peace and safety and where we're meant to be. So we come to a place of joy. And not only, of course, is Jesus the king, but he is the new Adam. He does restore everything in a way that Solomon could not. Solomon knew all about reptiles and plants. Jesus commands reptiles and plants. Now, we'll think more about this when we look at Romans 12 in the mornings and think about grace. When we serve God, we serve in his grace, in the resources he gives, which means we're never in debt to him. They go to get these cedars. They didn't chop down their own cedars. It's God provided for them. For each of them, it says, sat under their own vine and fig tree, another covenant promise. So we're never in debt to God because we only serve with the resources that God himself, in his grace, gave us. And then after that, he provides for us. And then after that, he invites us to his table freely. And so the blessings and wealth of God's covenant often are not visible now, rarely perhaps are visible now. But our inheritance is to come. And we do have some sort of taster and indicator of where we're going. But sometimes, you know, as with Hiram coming to Solomon, we get a glimpse of where we're going, that God is working his purposes out as his kingdom expands across the nations. but he will complete his project and we will have our reward. But now we labor, but not blindly or pointlessly, but for the joy of sitting at the king's table.